now hopefully we just went through to show you how powerful she really is, and this was a massive test. You know, like this is like her whole life was leading up to this, really. Clifford, here we are, another special. Really cranking these specials out. Really cranking them out.
It's a special special.
Oh, yeah. What are we doing today?
We're talking about Galadriel.
Yeah. We're also going to throw in a little bit more about the Rings of Power, too. Like, their creation and stuff. Like, we probably...
By the Rings of Power, do you mean to say the backstory that is maybe the basis for the whole Lord of the Rings?
Okay, so it's going to get kind of lengthy in that section because we're going to quote the most direct material we can about it because we just hear references of us and characters talking about the creation of it. But here it's like, okay, we're going to get as best we can with the two sources that Tolkien wrote about it, but that's going to lead to a bunch of long quotes in the middle. So if Galadriel's your thing, we're going to try to just make the episode convenient for you that you can, we'll let you know like what part to skip over if you don't want to hear about the Rings creation anymore. But we'll get there soon. We're going to start with
Galadriel. But you should pay attention because, I mean, it's important.
Yeah, right? Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, you know, I assume if you listen to all the shows so far, you'll probably listen to all this too. I mean, like, but I'm just trying to make it convenient for anybody else if the long, boring history isn't their jam. But I think...
Very thoughtful of you.
Yeah, but everybody that's gotten to this point, that probably is their jam. First impressions of Galadriel.
Well, I'll try to be unbiased by her representation in the movie, but she's, I mean, in some ways like a female version of Elrond, wise, serene, otherworldly. You get the impression that she's seen like more than any other character we've met so far.
Well, more than Elrond too, I'd say.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah.
But then she's like a little bit spookier.
Yeah.
In a way that Elrond's not. But I mean, on the whole, kind of the, she's like the, what's the right word? Where something's the most extreme version of itself.
Supreme?
Yeah, or the prototypical elf. Not prototypical.
Archetypal.
Archetypal elf. All of her characteristics are like elf characteristics just maxed out.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I can believe that. Yeah, I agree. All right, so that's not actually what we're getting into for this special, though, because you meet this character in basically two chapters of this book, and based on how much we've gone in depth with backstory for other things, I didn't see how we could pass this up. Like, this is a character that we should dive into. It gives us the ability to tell more Silmarillion stories about, especially, like, Second Age stuff, which is very sparse in all of his writing. So, like, that's when the rings are created, when they're fighting Sauron for, like, the first time. Mm-hmm. So I thought we would take this opportunity to just basically do this, use the special strictly to focus on her history within the context of the book. So, like, no, like, outside references or, like, what's inspired Galadriel or what she was supposed to be symbolizing. We should be getting into that in the chapters themselves. But for this, I just want to just really just dig into the history for it.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, we're going to have to truck through a lot of information because she is a very old character and she goes way back. Now, the other thing, though, is she goes way back in the history of Middle-earth itself. But she wasn't actually created in, like, Tolkien's mythology until, like, the writing of Lord of the Rings. Like, until they entered Lothlorien. Then he came up with her. Like, she was not a thing before that. He, literally, as he's writing this chapter, he's realizing, like, oh, Galadriel's got to be this really important person and, you know, have this big, huge storyline from, like, the Silmarillion and everything. But he's got to be developing that as he's writing it. And then afterwards, he's developing her history constantly all the way up until last month of his life. Because he's... This was actually...
So it certainly captured his imagination.
Right. And then, like, it also just to, like, figure out where she fit into everything. Because she was kind of... I will say this. I said we'd strictly be focusing on the history, but she's a lot like Idril, Tuor's wife in Gondolin. Like the strong, like pretty determined, pretty powerful woman, kind of. Galadriel becomes like the max version of that, you know, like, because there are other women like among like the Noldor and stuff, but like she's like the best, most powerful, and then she's also, she becomes the most important throughout their whole history, mostly because she survives the Silmarillion. but you know, he had to go back and like figure out where she fits into the Silmarillion, because that was like lots of the characters in the family trees were done, but then he had to insert her into there and figure out where she would fit in, and then all the stuff that she did leading up to Lord of the Rings. And then as he did that, her story just kept becoming more and more intricate, and she kept becoming more and more important. But the problem is, he has a bunch of draft ideas about how she fits in that don't fit together. Like, there's drafts of stuff that contradict each other. And it's like, even for Christopher Tolkien, it's a headache to go through it all. So You're going to get a taste of that as we do the special. But we're going to try to streamline it as much as possible for you to, like, kind of figure out all the events and everything. And, again, at the same time, we'll throw in that section about the Rings of Power, because that'll be, might as well cover it here. Like, this is probably the best spot we got.
Cool.
Okay, cool. So she is, I think I just said it. No, did I quite say it? Anyways, Galadriel is one of the Noldor princesses who's born in Valinor. So
she's like a second generation Valinor, or second generation Noldor.
I guess technically third generation. So there's three families of elves.
Okay.
There's the Vanyar, there's the Noldor, and then there's the Teleri.
Mm-hmm.
So each family has one patriarch of the family.
Uh-huh.
And then they all have kids, and then those kids have kids, and Galadriel's in that third bracket.
Okay.
So she's one of the Noldor, which means the Noldor's head of the family was Finwë, and then he had three sons. Fëanor was the oldest with his first wife, but then she actually died. And then he had a second wife where he had Fingolfin was his second son, and then Finarfin was his third son. And so she's going to be the only daughter of Finarfin. But do you want to read that first chunk there?
Galadriel and her brother Finrod were the children of Finarfin, the second son of Indis. Finarfin was of his mother's kind in mind and body, having the golden hair of the Vanyar, their noble and gentle temper, and their love of the Valar. As well as he could be kept aloof from the strife of his brothers and their estrangement from the Valar, and he often sought peace among the Teleri, whose language he learned. He wedded Erwin, the daughter of King Olwë of Alqualondë, and his children were thus king of King Aelu Thingol of Doriath and Beleriand, for he was the brother of Olwë, and this kinship influenced their decision to join in the exile, and proved of great importance later in Beleriand. Finrod was like his father in his fair face and golden hair, and also in noble and generous heart, though he had the high courage of the Noldor, and in his youth their eagerness and unrest. And he had seen also from his Telerian mother a love of the sea and dreams of far lands that he had never seen. Galadriel was the greatest of the Noldor, except Fëanor maybe, though she was wiser than he, and her wisdom increased with the long years.
And there were at least two characters that we met before. Did you recognize them?
Well, Thingol of Doriath.
Yep, okay.
We've met him before.
Yep.
And we met Finarfin?
No.
Erwin?
Finrod. Say Finrod.
Finrod?
Yeah. Okay, now where at?
well, certainly in the Silmarillion.
Okay, he was the one that helped Beren try to sneak towards Angband, and then they got captured by Sauron, and then they had the Battle of the Bands, and then the werewolf ate him.
That's right. Okay.
Yep. Okay.
The werewolf ate Finrod.
Right. And so then, immortally wounded him. It didn't quite eat him, because he killed it, you know, but he died too. Okay. But, and then Thingol, we've talked about multiple times, King of Doriath, so he's the leader of the Sindar Elves.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't make it to... So the Sindar Elves are the Grey Elves. They're the ones that stayed in Beleriand and didn't make it across the sea of the Teleri. But half the Teleri did make it, and so that's who Finarfin, Galadriel, and Finrod's dad married. So they're half Teleri, I guess, which means when they came to Middle-earth, Thingol befriended them because basically their mom was his niece.
Okay.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So he's like a distant uncle.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. All right. Now let's keep going. You want to read that next section too?
Sure. Her mother name was Nerwind, man maiden, and she grew to be tall beyond the measure even of the women of the Noldor. She was strong of body, mind, and will, a match for both the lore masters and the athletes of the Eldar in the days of their youth. Even among the Eldar, she was accounted beautiful, and her hair was held a marvel unmatched. It was golden like the hair of her father and of her foremother Indis, but richer and more radiant, for its gold was touched by some memory of the star-like silver of her mother, and the Eldar said that the light of the two trees, Lorelin and Telperion, had been snared in her tresses. Many thought that this saying first gave to Fëanor thought of imprisoning and blending the light of the trees that later took shape in his hands as the Cimmerils. For Fëanor beheld the hair of Galadriel with wonder and delight. He begged 3 times for a tress, but Galadriel would not give him even one hair. These two kinsfolk, the greatest of the Eldar of Valinor, were unfriends forever.
Okay, so that's pretty big too. So her physical feature of like kind of very golden and flowing and almost glowing hair possibly gave rise to the Fëanor creating the Silmarils.
It's crazy.
That's a pretty big deal. Yeah, that's pretty cool. And then notably, so Fëanor's her half-uncle,
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't like him. She just has like a weird feeling around him all the time, doesn't like him, and just gets bad vibes.
I mean, we haven't talked about Fëanor specifically, but we've mentioned in some stories how he brings some bad vibes to the Silmarillion.
Yeah, and we've talked about his crappy sons.
Right.
5/7 of his sons suck.
Yeah, and it's worth that this line earlier, Galadriel was the greatest of the Noldor, except Fëanor maybe, though she was wiser than he. So, I mean, clearly there's some competition there.
Right, and it's
probably... Seems like they're kind of bound to be at each other's throats.
Yeah.
If they're the two greatest of the Noldor.
Yeah, but Fëanor's like a generation up, so I feel like he still has like some sort of elder respect. But then again, she's a woman, so she gets like some gentleman courtesy respect too, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So I don't know. It's interesting. Yeah, just kind of Tolkien coming straight out like, yeah, this woman's as powerful or more powerful than all these great princes of the Noldor that we've heard about throughout the whole Silmarillion.
Yeah, cool. I mean, we know the Noldor are the greatest of the elves. Can we say that safely?
No, we can't.
Okay.
They're the most holy. No, most crafty. They're probably the least holy. They're the most crafty. The Vanyar are the noblest elves, okay? But okay. Maybe for might and power, maybe, because some of the Vanyar probably don't care. Like, they're just happy to be peaceful.
Who are the Vanyar again?
They're the first tribe of elves. And they...
Did they go... They didn't go over to Valinor.
No, they did. They came with... Them and the Noldor came first. And they were just like... They're just like... They're the perfect oldest child. And they're so perfect that there's no stories about them because they didn't do anything wrong. That's why the Noldor are interesting, because they mess up.
Like, understood.
And they can be corrupted. So that's kind of the deal here. But when they say like an elf's mighty or like powerful and stuff, then that's a big deal. And yeah, the Noldor have lots of those. But lots of them, besides Fëanor, are ones that have Vanyar or Teleri blood in them, or both, or all three. You want to take the next one, too?
Galadriel was born in the bliss of Valinor, but it was not long, in the reckoning of the Blessed Realm, before that was dimmed, and thereafter she had no peace within. For in that testing time amid the strife of the Noldor, she was drawn this way and that. She was proud, strong, and self-willed, as were all the descendants of Finwë, save Finarfin. And like her brother Finrod, of all her dreams of far lands and dominions that might be her own to order as she would without tutelage. Yet deeper still there dwelt in her the noble and generous spirit of the Vanyar, and a reverence for the Valar that she could not forget. From her earliest years she had a marvelous gift of insight into the minds of others, but judged them with mercy and understanding, and she withheld her good will from none save only Fëanor. In him she perceived darkness that she hated and feared, though she did not perceive that the shadow of the same evil had fallen upon the minds of all the Noldor, and upon her own.
Okay, so she doesn't like Fëanor, again, that's emphasized. But then she's not perfect here because she has a desire to basically just have lands and dominions that might be her own.
Mm-hmm.
And then also what it's saying is she can tell, like, there's, like, a dark cloud over Fëanor, but she doesn't realize that there's basically at least a lesser but still dark cloud over all the Noldor and herself included.
Hmm. Okay.
But so that's kind of the idea, and especially as he's developing this very late in life, he's developing the idea that Galadriel wants to leave Valinor and just go see the world and see what she can do in Middle-earth and, like, possibly, like, have a kingdom of her own and everything. Mm-hmm. Like, she's probably the first one to have this idea, okay?
Yeah, I mean, this, without going off on way too much of a tangent here, it's not too far removed from Music of the Ainur when Melkor wants a part greater than the one he was given.
It's definitely like the pride again and the ambition, right? You know, like the selfish ambition. Yeah,
there's a little bit of that going on. So
right. Yep.
We'll keep that in mind.
Yeah. You want to take this last paragraph for this section?
So it came to pass that when the light of Valinor faded, for even as the Noldor thought, she joined the rebellion against the Valar, who commanded them to stay. And once she had set foot upon the road of exile, she would not relent, but rejected the last message of the Valar, and came under the doom of Mandos. Her pride was unwilling to return, a defeated suppliant for pardon. But now she burned with desire to follow Fëanor, and her anger to whatever lands he might come, and to thwart him in all the ways that she could. Pride moved her, when, at the end of the Elder Days, after the final overthrow of Morgoth, she refused the pardon of the Valar for all those who had fought against him, and remained in Middle-earth.
Okay, so there's the pride clearly on display there. Now, what they're talking about, the light of Valinor failing, that's a story that we will cover very soon in another special. We'll dive into it there, but this is the cause for the Noldor to leave, which Fëanor then leads them all, because they go back to Middle-earth, because I think we've said it before, Morgoth steals the Silmarils from Fëanor,
mm-hmm.
and runs away back to Middle-earth, and Fëanor leads the whole army against him. So now Galadriel, obviously, has to go with them because she wanted to go anyways before this point, but she goes along too, like, not to aid Fëanor, but, like, just because, like, the rest of her kinsmen are going, and then she doesn't want to be left behind, plus she wanted to go to Middle-earth anyways. Actually, this kind of brings up too, in the last month of his life, this was the very last thing he worked on for Middle-earth, probably. Tolkien was gonna rechange her story, like, very dramatically. Like, she was gonna have her marry a Teleri elf that was living in Valinor at the time. And the Teleri elves are like the sea elves, so they're really good about building boats. And so she was gonna have them build a boat, and then when Fëanor was getting ready to leave, they would suddenly leave in the boat and then sail across to Middle-earth and be the first ones back. And then they would greet probably Círdan, because he was the shipwright that's always at the edge. He's still in Lord of the Rings times, too. He's still alive there. And they were going to visit him and just warn him, like, hey, Fëanor is bringing an army of Noldor, and Melkor just escaped with the Silmarils, so, like, Middle-earth better put on a helmet, because things are going to get rough, you know? Mm. You can just warn him about that. But that wasn't included in the published Silmarillion by Christopher Tolkien, because, like, that was just a projected outline, and then before he could actually write any sort of drafts for it or anything, he passed away. And so Christopher Tolkien's like, well, I can't really include this. Plus, it also contradicts that what's printed in Lord of the Rings, that her husband Celeborn was a Sindar elf, who we're going to meet in a second here.
Okay.
Christopher Tolkien, he kind of sums up her part in Beleriand throughout the Silmarillion pretty well, so we might as well just read that, because that'll just actually be the quickest way to say this. So you want to go for all those names there?
Yeah. Galadriel, coming to Middle-earth as one of the leaders of the second host of the Noldor, met Celeborn in Doriath, and was later wedded to him. He was the grandson of Thingol's brother Elmo, a shadowy figure about whom nothing is told, save that he was the younger brother of Elwë, Thingol, and Olwë, and was beloved of Elwë, with whom he remained. Elmo's son was named Galadon, and his sons were Celeborn and Galathiel. Galathiel was the father of Nimloth, who wedded Deor Thingol's heir, and was the mother of Elwing. By this genealogy, Celeborn was a kinsman of Galadriel, the granddaughter of Olwë of Aqualondë, but not so close as by that in which he became Olwë's grandson. It is a natural assumption that Celeborn and Galadriel were present at the ruin of Doriath. It is said in one place that Celeborn escaped the sack of Doriath, and perhaps aided the escape of Elwing to the havens of Sirion with the Cimmeril, but this is nowhere stated. Celeborn is mentioned in Appendix B to Lord of the Rings as dwelling for a time in Lindon south of the Lune. But early in the Second Age, they passed over the mountains into Eriador. Their subsequent history, in the same phase, so to call it, of my father's writing, is told in the short narrative that follows here.
Oh, it's not a short narrative. forgot to cross that out. Okay, so anyways, so that doesn't... All right, so Christopher Tolkien just summed all that up. I know that was like family trees of names that are hard to remember. Nimloth, though, that was the one that married Dior. Dior was Brynn and Lúthien's kid, remember? And mm-hmm, then from mm-hmm. there, they have Elwing, and then Elwing marries Arendil, mm-hmm. and then they have Elrond and Elros, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, though, more interesting, back to the point with Galadriel. In the chapter, the Mirror Galadriel that we just did, it does say that, like, she literally has a line that says, we crossed over the mountains, which I would presume is the Blue Mountains, which cuts off Beleriand from, like, basically, like, the Shire and, like, the Rivendell kind of continent.
Okay.
She said they crossed over there before the fall of Nargothrond and Gondolin. And we've actually talked about the fall of both those cities. The Gondolin mm-hmm. one, you should remember. The Nargothrond one, we talked about all the way back in our dragon special.
Yeah.
In The Hobbit. So it's kind of, that doesn't quite match up, but whatever, we'll just go with it. More importantly, let's remember when she set out from Valinor, she was the first one that wanted to leave Valinor kind of just to see the world herself, you know, and mm-hmm. like possibly rule a kingdom and just like... almost like leave to go make her fortune somewhere else.
Right.
But she spends the whole Silmarillion, so the whole First Age, she's seeing all of her brothers and her cousins just setting up kingdoms all over Beleriand to like basically hold back Morgoth in the north. And like literally every single one of her brothers and every single one of her male cousins were doing this. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, she doesn't try to even set up a kingdom. She just goes to Beleriand and lives with King Thingol, who is a kinsman. And then he's living, you know, his wife's Melian the Maiar. So it's mm-hmm. like, well, she would be a good mentor and everything, like probably the best in Middle Earth. But it's just like, didn't you come here to like set up a kingdom and, you know, just be a ruler yourself? Like, why aren't you doing that?
Right, right.
So let's keep that in mind as we go forward for the rest of her history and we enter the Second Age.
To slow you down, what defines the Second Age?
The Silmarillion is the First Age, and that's called the Elder Days.
Right, okay.
The Second Age starts right after that. The Second Age ends with Sauron, with Isildur cutting the ring off Sauron's finger.
Okay, with the Last Alliance. And Lord of the Rings is set in the Third Age.
At the very end of the Third Age, yeah.
Okay.
I guess they don't know it's the end of the Third Age, but 3,000 years into the Third Age.
Yeah.
Okay. So we got 6,000 years to bridge still.
Okay.
As we're 25 minutes in the episode.
Okay, get cracking.
Okay, so there's two sources for this thing. Most of this information is going to be coming from the Unfinished Tales, and Galadriel and Celeborn just have a chapter themselves. Now, there's also, at the section of, in the book, the Silmarillion book, it's not like a proper chapter of the Silmarillion itself, but in the Silmarillion book, he just put this story at the end that was one of his dad's drafts called The Rings of Power, and that basically tells like the whole creation of the ring. So we're going to draw on that for a little bit too, but it's mostly just going to come from Unfinished Tales here. So this will be a lot of history. I think most people are pretty ready to strap themselves in for this point, but we are going to be quoting a lot, so it might get boring. So I will insert here where to skip to if you just get bored with this and you want to just get back to Galadriel history. Jump to around minute 56-ish. You should be able to find the break. Okay, cool. With that, you've been warned. Let's go for it.
I'm braced.
You're like, Clifford, I kind of feel bad for you that you do this stuff. But anyways, whatever. It's good for you to know since you're doing a Lord of the Rings podcast.
I've got my next drink.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Okay, so at the end of the Second Age, Galadriel and Celeborn refuse to take the part and go back to Valinor, right? Because Eowyn, like, the whole Valar army came. Remember, we covered this in the Rendil special. The whole Valar army came, captured Morgoth, took him back, and they said, like, hey, all the elves are welcome to come back with us to Valinor and, you know, your pardon and everything. But Galadriel and Celeborn reject this. Celeborn, partly because he's from Middle-earth and he loves it there and he wants to stay in Middle-earth. And then Galadriel, partly out of pride and partly for love of her husband, is like, no, I'm not going back.
Mm-hmm.
So they cross over the Blue Mountains, which, again, if you look at the regular Middle-earth map, if you find the Shire, if you go just west that's the Blue Mountains, and there's like a gap in between them now where the Grey Havens are. That's when this gap formed, is at the in that War of Wrath where the Valar all defeat Morgoth. Because every time the Valar fight, like, the world gets changed. Beleriand sinks at that time. Like, it just gets, like, destroyed throughout the whole 50-year war or something, or whatever it is. If you look at the regular map in Lord of the Rings, there's, like, a patch of land behind there that's still around, and that's called Lindon. But then they cross over those mountains, which are the Blue Mountains, and then you go back into, like, real Middle Earth there, and that's Eriador for the first part, and then you cross the Misty Mountains, and then you're in Wilderland. And if you go south, you find the White Mountains, which is where they eventually set up Gondor. Okay. Okay, now that that's out of the way, so they cross the Blue Mountains and they gather a whole bunch of different types of elves. So there's gray elves, which are the Sindar elves. Green elves are actually the ones that came later to Beleriand, and they lived near, like, Osirian's. So, like, if you look at a map of Beleriand, you'll find it. Osirian's the place with a bunch of rivers near it, like seven rivers. And that's where Beren and Lúthien went to live at the end when they came back to life for the last part of their mortal life. But then there's also elves that never even went to Beleriand, and they're known as Nandor elves. So, you know, again, he's doing all this because there's the distinction between light elves and dark elves in real mythology, and he was trying to make up actual classifications. So this is how you get it. So, like, the Teleri that should have gone to Valinor but didn't are the gray elves, the Sindar. And then the ones that came to join him later in Beleriand are the green elves. And that's probably, that's most likely what Legolas actually is.
And they're dark elves.
All the Sindar are also dark elves, but yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the Nandor are the darkest elves of all, because they never came to Beleriand. Like, they were just like, the Valar tried to summon all the elves to Beleriand, and the Nandor elves were like, like, they went a little bit of the way, and then they're like, no, forget it. We don't want to go. We like it here. Okay. So they lived near Lake Nenuel, which is just north of the Shire, but of course at this time the Shire didn't exist because hobbits hadn't moved there yet. We covered that in the prologue of Lord of the Rings. They have two kids for now, which is kind of weird. Their son Amroth and their daughter Celebrienne. Is that how you would say it?
Celebrienne?
Yeah, it's not Celebrienne.
No. Okay. Celebrienne?
Yeah, okay. So where have we heard Amroth before?
Amroth was mentioned because his lover or wife was Nimrodel, the river that they crossed over
on the way into
Lothlorien, right?
Right, right. Good job, Clifford. Golf clap. You got one. Yeah, so we just covered this like a chapter or two ago. Kind of weird that that's their son, right?
Yeah.
Because that song was pretty depressing from what I remember.
Yeah, and it had the ring of like being super, super ancient.
Right. So we will address that later, but for now let's just go with it that this is their son.
Okay.
Okay, why don't you just read that quote right there?
But eventually Galadriel became aware that Sauron again, as in the ancient days of the captivity of Melkor, had been left behind. Or rather, since Sauron had as yet no single name, and his operations had not been perceived to proceed from a single evil spirit, prime servant of Melkor, she perceived that there was an evil controlling purpose abroad in the world, and that it seemed to proceed from a source further to the east, beyond Eriador and the Misty Mountains.
Okay, so we're on board with that. So Melkor's been taken away and thrown into the Dor Night, but now there's still something left. Like, there's some sort of evil force around. And maybe multiple sources. Like, Sauron might just be one of them. And Sauron, they don't even identify as just one single dude. Because they, I guess, hadn't known him by just one name yet.
Right.
Okay.
It sounds kind of like if evil was some sort of radar signal, he's not pinging out, like, a defined signal. It's like it's kind of diffuse.
Right. But then it's also, there's, like, a concentration somewhere in the east, beyond the Misty Mountains.
Okay. Right.
Hint, hint, it's Mordor. Celeborn and Galadriel, around the year 700 of the Second Age, go on to establish the Eregion Kingdom, which we've also heard about before. Now, of course, one of the important people there is Celebrimbor, so he must be with them at this point, right? Galadriel is very aware that Eregion is close to Khazad Dûm, which is also weird because Celeborn dislikes all dwarves because he's never forgiven their part in the destruction of Doriath. Remember, King Thingol got killed by dwarves? And then they ran away with the Silmaril, and then
the ancient grudge.
Yeah, yeah, that was the foundation of that.
That's already happened, and Celeborn is close to him.
Right, but these Khazad Dûm dwarves, which are the Durin's folk, which is what Thorin and now Gimli are, you know, related to, they had nothing to do with the ruin of Doriath, so he shouldn't really actually have a grudge against these dwarves.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that makes him racist. I don't know. So, like, actually, you know, like, these are, like, real defined racist.
Mm-hmm.
You want to read that quote there?
In any case, Galadriel was more farsighted in this than Celeborn, and she perceived from the beginning that Middle-earth could not be saved from the residue of evil that Morgoth had left behind him, save by a union of all the peoples who were in their way and in their measure opposed to him. She looked upon the dwarves also with the eye of a commander, seeing in them the finest warriors to pit against the orcs. Moreover, Galadriel was a Noldor, and she had a natural sympathy with their minds and their passionate love of crafts of hand, a sympathy much greater than that found among many of the Eldar. The dwarves were the children of Aule, and Galadriel, like others of the Noldor, had been a pupil of Aule and Ivana in Valinor.
Okay, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
That speaks for itself. Galadriel, very farsighted, resourceful, and just ready to unite everybody to fight evil.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. I like
also it. A little sinister, though. She's got the eye of a commander. She's ready to throw them into battle.
Okay, maybe this is like... This might be weird because this is like the first special we're doing that I think it's the first special we're doing that just focuses on a woman per se. But like, I don't want to sound like sexist and stuff, but like, are most women the ones thinking like battle commanders throughout the history of the world?
Probably not.
I think that's a cool detail and point in her favor that she's just getting ready for that kind of thing, as opposed to throwing soldiers to be cannon fodder.
Definitely, definitely. I think she's being smart about it, but it's very crafty to be considering an alliance with somebody for the sake of a future battle to be had.
And she's also like looking beyond race and just say, okay, are you a good guy? Okay, what's your skills? Let's utilize your skills.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Like I said, Celebrimbor was there. Reading like the whole history of Lord of the Rings, what we've done so far, and then what's in the appendices, you'd assume Celebrimbor was the straight up leader of the Eregion elves, because this is where they make the Rings of Power, which we're about to get into. And in some other draft, at some other phase of like the mythology, as Tolkien was working on it, he probably was. But the idea that Celeborn and Galadriel founded this settlement doesn't actually contradict anything in the Silmarillion or Lord of the Rings. It's just not heard before. So I think it's fair game to go with it.
Okay.
You want to read a little bit about Celebrimbor, though? He's pretty important here.
Celebrimbor had an almost dwarvish obsession with crafts, and he soon became the chief artificier of Eregion, entering into a close relationship with the dwarves of Khazad-dûm, among whom his greatest friend was Narvi. Both the elves and dwarves had great profit from this association, so that Eregion became far stronger and Khazad-dûm more beautiful than either would have done alone.
Okay. Do we need a refresh on who Celebrimbor is, too? We talked about him like a couple episodes ago or something.
He's a son of Fëanor?
Grandson.
Grandson of Fëanor. So he's right. Got the Fëanor's curse hangs over his head.
No, because that was all pardoned at the end of the Silmarillion.
But okay.
Especially since he had like basically rejected his father, because his father was Curufin, and he saw how like crappy Curufin and Celegorm were to Lúthien, that he's just like, I don't want any part of you. You're not my dad anymore. Go away.
Okay, I got Curufin confused with Celebrimbor.
Okay, yeah, so...
Curufin and Celegorm were the guys who hassled Beren and Lúthien in the forest.
Yeah, okay. And so this is Curufin's son, and yeah, so he's basically the greatest elvish smith since Fëanor himself. And okay. he would like to eclipse him if possible.
Fëanor, who made the Cimmarils.
Fëanor, who made the Silmarils, who they just said was the mightiest Noldor of all time.
Yes.
Though Galadriel rivals him, which mm-hmm. is kind of cool. And that's why we're doing a special about her. Okay, anyways, this Narvi guy, where have we heard him before? This is a little harder, but also
maybe a mention while they were in the Mines of Moria, something was named after him?
Good guess. On a technicality, they were not quite in the Mines of Moria. Does that give you a hint?
Oh, no.
He was the one that made the Moria dwarf door that they entered.
Oh, okay.
Like, if you read this stuff, it's like, I think it says Celebrimbor made these signs, but then this was made by
Narvi.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, fun stuff.
So anyways, they're two craftsmen and they're friends.
Yeah, and then you want to read whatever I put next?
The building of the chief city of Eregion, Ost-il-Edil, was begun in about the year 750 of the Second Age. News of these things came to the ears of Sauron, and increased the fears that he felt concerning the coming of the Numenoreans to Lindon, and the coast further south, and their friendship with Gil-galad. Sauron therefore left Eriador alone for a while, and he chose the land of Mordor, as it was afterwards called, for a stronghold as a counter to the threat of the Numenorean landings. When he felt himself to be secure, he sent emissaries to Eriador, and finally, in about the year 1200 of the Second Age, came himself, wearing the faintest form that he could contrive.
Okay, so Sauron's on the move again, and again, they can't quite pick out that this is Sauron, the second most evil guy of all time.
Mm-hmm. But he's scared at this point. If he gets discovered, he's totally on his back foot, and he'll be destroyed or captured, is the assumption.
Right, and the Numenoreans that they're talking about, those are the men that helped in the Silmarillion. They got the island of Numenor as a reward, which is 2/3 of the way across the sea towards Valinor. And so they're becoming powerful now, too. And they're coming back to Middle-earth because they basically have nothing better to do. And they're the best mariners of all time. Partly because they're descendants of Arendil. Mm-hmm. So Region, we know that's on the west side of the Misty Mountains because we went through that land throughout Lord of the Rings. Galadriel makes contact with the Nandor elves on the other side of the Misty Mountains who are living in the Lorinand Forest, which at this time extended on both sides of the river. So it was really big. So it probably merged with Greenwood, the Great Greenwood, but that becomes known as Mirkwood. Okay, so at this time it was one huge forest.
Okay.
At this point, there wasn't much organization because Morgoth had never threatened them because he was always only ever focused on Beleriand. So, like, any elves that had lived there since, like, literally the time they woke up have just had peace and basically quiet just in the starlight and everything, and that was just it. So it seems Galadriel wants to use this force as a defense against whatever this nameless evil is that she can't pick up on, but she knows that it's the biggest threats in the east, so she wants to, you know, utilize this forest partly for the defense there, is what I gathered from what I was reading. But again, this is all kind of hazy. Now, again, remember, Sauron can change appearance, and so they didn't know that the entire evil threat basically centers on one master source at this point.
Mm-hmm. So is Sauron spying at them?
No, he's, like, actually going among them and trying to, like, befriend them.
Okay.
But in Lindon, for example, what did Gil-galad do?
In Lindon, Gil-galad shut down Sauron's emissaries, and even Sauron himself. But Sauron had better fortune with the Noldor of Eregion, and especially with Celebrimbor, who desired in his heart to rival the skill and the fame of Fëanor.
Okay, I'm going to read part of the Rings of Power document. We've been going through Unfinished Tales up until this point. So you can kind of compare these two, too, to see if they actually line up and fit together, and they basically do, if not totally do. So anyways, here's this part. Men, Sauron found, the easiest to sway of all the peoples of Middle-earth, but long he sought to persuade the elves to his service. For he knew that the firstborn had the greater power, and he went far and wide among them, and his hue was still that of one both fair and wise. Only in Lindon did he not come, for Gil-galad and Elrond doubted him and his fair seeming. And though they knew not who in truth he was, they would not admit him into that land. But elsewhere the elves received him gladly, and few among them hearkened to the messengers from Lindon bidding them beware. For Sauron took to himself the name Annatar, the Lord of Gifts, and they had at first much profit from his friendship. And he said to them, "Alas for the weakness of the great! For the mighty King Gil-galad, and wise in all lore, is Master Elrond, and yet they will not aid me in my labors. Can it be that they do not desire to see other lands become as blissful as their own? But wherefore should Middle-earth remain forever desolate and dark, whereas the elves could make it as fair as Eorzea, nay, even as Valinor? And since they have not returned thither, as you might, I perceive that you love this Middle-earth as I do. Is it not then our task to labor together for its enrichment, and for the raising of all the elven kindreds that wander here untaught to the height of that power and knowledge which those who have are beyond the sea? It was in Eregion that the counsels of Sauron were most gladly received, for in all the land the Noldor desired ever to increase the skill and subtlety of their works. Moreover, they were not at peace in their hearts, since they had refused to return into the West, and they desired both to stay in Middle-earth, which they indeed loved, and yet to enjoy the bliss of those that had departed." Jumping back to the Unfinished Tales story of Galadriel, do you want to read that next one?
In Eregion, Sauron posed as an emissary of the Valar, sent by them to Middle-earth, or ordered them to remain there to give aid to the Elves. He perceived at once that Galadriel would be his chief adversary and obstacle, and he endeavored therefore to placate her, bearing her scorn with outward patience and courtesy. Sauron used all his arts upon Celebrimbor and his fellow smiths, who had formed a society or brotherhood, very powerful in Eregion, the Gwaith Ir Mirdain. But he worked in secret, unknown to Galadriel and Celeborn. Before long, Sauron had the Gwaith Ir Mirdain under his influence, for at first they had great profit from his instruction in secret matters of their craft. So great became his hold on the Mirdain that at length he persuaded them to revolt against Galadriel and Celeborn, and to seize power in Eregion, and that was at some time between 1350 and 1400 of the Second Age. Galadriel thereupon left Eregion and passed through Khazad-dûm to Lorinand, taking with her Amroth and Celebrion. But Celeborn would not enter the mansions of the dwarves, and he remained behind in Eregion, disregarded by Celebrimbor. In Lorinand, Galadriel took up rule and defense against Sauron.
Okay, and now we come to the most, I guess, first-hand account of the creation of the ring itself.
Okay.
Like I said before, we've had other characters just reference the creation of the rings, and we've just referenced it and stuff, but this is about the most first-hand thing you'll ever get. Of course, it was just written by Tolkien, who was also writing all the references that the characters are making. So, I don't know how much better it is, but here it is. Now, the elves made many rings, but secretly Sauron made one ring to rule all the others, and their power was bound up with it, to be subject wholly to it, and to it last only so long as it should last. And much of the strength and will of Sauron passed into the One Ring, for the power of the elven rings was very great, and that which should govern them must be a thing of surpassing potency. And Sauron forged it in the Mountain of Fire in the Land of Shadow, and while he wore the One Ring, he could perceive all things that were done by means of the lesser rings, and he could see and govern the very thoughts of those that wore them. But the elves were not so lightly to be caught. As soon as Sauron set the One Ring upon his finger, they were aware of him, and they knew him, and perceived that he would be master of them, and of any that they wrought. Then in anger and fear, they took off their rings. But he, finding that he was betrayed and that the elves were not deceived, was filled with wrath, and he came against them with open war, demanding that all the rings should be delivered to him, since the elven smiths could not have attained to their making without his lure and counsel. But the elves fled from him, and three of their rings they saved, and bore them away and hid them. Now these were the three that had last been made, and they possessed the greatest powers. Narnia, Nenya, and Vilya, they were named, the rings of fire and of water and of air, set with ruby and adamant and sapphire. And of all the elven rings, Sauron most desired to possess them, for those who had made them in their keeping could ward off the decays of time and postpone the weariness of the world. But Sauron could not discover them, for they were given into the hands of the wise, who concealed them and never again used them openly while Sauron kept the ruling ring. Therefore, the three remained unsullied, for they were forged by Celebrimbor alone, and the hand of Sauron had never touched them. Yet, they also were subject to the One. That actually took him a long time. Like, in the history of developing Lord of the Rings, that idea took him a long time, that, like, the three elven rings were only by Celebrimbor, so they're the most pure of them, because the other ones Sauron basically helped with.
Yeah, it's kind of confusing, because he still has control over them.
Well, because he knows, because they made the other ones first. So, like, he basically, when he made the One Ring, he knows how to harness the power of any sort of ring. But the last ones that they made, Celebrimbor just did by himself. So they're the most powerful because he did it without Sauron's help. But Sauron, if you make a magic ring of power, it's going to be connected to the One.
If it's being worn.
Right. That's the other distinction, too. So at this point, they take them off. When the ring gets cut eventually, then they put the rings back on, and then their lands. That's what they said. Ward off decays of time and postpone the weariness of the world. So, again, we'll come to that later in the special, but let's just keep trucking through this stuff.
Okay.
Back to the situation that's going on in Eregion. What do you got?
Now, Celebrimbor was not corrupted in heart or faith, but had accepted Sauron as what he posed to be. And when at length he discovered the existence of the One Ring, he revolted against Sauron and went to Lorinand to take counsel once more with Galadriel. They should have destroyed all the rings of power this time, but they failed to find the strength. Galadriel counseled him that the three rings of the elves should be hidden, never used, and dispersed, far from Eregion where Sauron believed them to be. It was at that time that she received Nenya, the White Ring, from Celebrimbor, and by its power the realm of Lorinand was strengthened and made beautiful, but its power upon her was also great and unforeseen, for it increased her latent desire for the sea and for return into the west, so that her joy in Middle-earth was diminished. Celebrimbor followed her counsel that the Ring of Air and the Ring of Fire should be sent out of Eregion, and he entrusted them to Gil-galad and Lindon.
Alright, and now what happened to Celebrimbor?
When Sauron learned of the repentance and revolt of Celebrimbor, his disguise fell and his wrath was revealed, and gathering a great force, he moved over Celynardon, Rohan, to the invasion of Eriador in the year 1695. When news of this reached Gil-galad, he sent out a force under Elrond Half-Elven. But Elrond had far to go, and Sauron turned north and made at once for Eregion. The scouts and vanguard of Sauron's host were already approaching when Celgorm made a sortie and drove them back. But though he was able to join his force to that of Elrond, they could not return to Eregion, for Sauron's host was far greater than theirs. great enough both to hold them off and closely to invest Eregion. At last, the attackers broke into Eregion with ruin and devastation and captured the chief object of Sauron's assault, the House of the Myrdane, where were their smithies and their treasures. Celebrimbor, desperate, himself withstood Sauron on the steps of the great door of the Myrdane, but he was grappled and taken captive, and the house was ransacked. There Sauron took the 9 rings and other lesser works of the Myrdane, but the 7 and the 3 he could not find. Then Celebrimbor was put to torment, and Sauron learned from him where the 7 were bestowed. This Celebrimbor revealed, because neither the 7 nor the 9 did he value as he valued the 3. The 7 and the 9 were made with Sauron's aid, whereas the 3 were made by Celebrimbor alone, with a different power and purpose. It is not actually said here that Sauron at this time took possession of the 7 rings, though the implication seems clear that he did. Concerning the 3 rings, Sauron could learn nothing from Celebrimbor, and he had him put to death. But he guessed the truth, that the 3 had been committed to Elvish guardians, and that must mean to Galadriel and Gil-galad. In black anger, he turned to battle, and bearing as a banner Celebrimbor's body hung upon a pole, shot through with orc arrows, he turned upon the forces of Elrond. Elrond had gathered such a few of the elves of Eregion as had escaped, but he had no force to withstand the onset. He would indeed have been overwhelmed had not Sauron's host been attacked in the rear, for Durin sent out a force of dwarves from Khazad-dûm, and with them came elves of Lorinand led by Amroth. Elrond was able to extricate himself, but he was forced away northwards, and it was at that time, in the year 1697, according to the Tale of Years, that he established a refuge and stronghold at Imladris, Rivendell. Sauron withdrew the pursuit of Elrond and turned upon the dwarves and the elves of Lorinand, whom he drove back, but the gates of Moria were shut, and he could not enter. Ever afterwards, Moria had Sauron's hate, and all orcs were commanded to harry dwarves whenever they might.
Okay, interesting. That's a lot. What do you think? You still with us?
Things came to a head pretty quickly.
Yeah, yeah. So this is like the very first big war with Sauron.
It seems like he went really quickly from being kind of a shadow, not wanting to reveal himself, not wanting to be caught, still present in the world, to all of a sudden leading a massive army against all the dwarves and elves.
Well, it sounded when he put on the One Ring, he didn't expect that people would perceive that he put it on. But they did, because Celebrimbor by himself had made the 3 rings. So Sauron, I guess, didn't expect that as he forged the 1.
Okay.
And so from there, it's like, that was supposed to be his, like, ace in the hole kind of thing. But now that's exposed, and he doesn't have any kind of backup or anything. So it's just like, all right, well, we got to go all-out war to get all these things now. Because I want these rings of power. Because I just put all this power into having the 1. I want the other ones, and I want to give them to the people that will follow me.
So it's like, Celebrimbor was almost like a double agent. Sauron was an agent. Celebrimbor was like a double agent.
No. Celebrimbor was foolish enough to believe whatever fair presence Sauron had. He's just like, oh, this guy's a wise guy. I'm going to learn from him because I want to rival Fëanor, my ancestor.
But unwittingly, because he then secretly made the 3 rings independent of Sauron without telling him.
Yeah, possibly, maybe.
He kind of threw off Sauron's sneaky maneuvers.
A little bit. I don't know if that was like super intentional, like double agent level intentionality.
Okay.
You know, fair. But yeah. Okay. Anyways, let's just go over real quick what happens to Sauron here. That was the end of the lengthy quotes, I think, if anybody's wondering. So if you made it through that, you're golden for the rest of this thing. Okay. So now Sauron, at this point, he knows his best shot at one or multiple of the rings is to attack Gil-galad and Lindon. So Lindon all the way past the Shire at the Grey Havens. So like, that's like way out of his way from Mordor. Like that's doing the reverse of what the Fellowship is doing right now.
Mm-hmm. And Gil-galad's one of the most important elves, right?
He's also one of the Noldor that actually survived the Silmarillion.
Right.
I guess we could talk about it a little bit. He's the son of Fingon. We heard about Fingon. I would bet $20 you do not remember who Fingon is. But who do you think Fingon is?
Finrod's brother?
No.
Fëanor's brother?
No.
I don't know.
Turgon's brother.
Okay.
Okay, so Turgon, remember, he was the one that founded Gondolin. Finrod's the older brother. Turgon's the second brother. They're the sons of Fingolfin, who is the older of Fingolfin and Finarfin. Finarfin is Galadriel and Finrod's dad. Okay? So Fingon and Turgon are Galadriel's first cousins, full cousins, because then there's the Fëanor, the sons of Fëanor would be Galadriel's half cousins, because Fëanor has a different mom, but they all have the same grandpa.
Okay.
And Fëanor's their half uncle.
But what? How did Gil-galad distinguish himself?
Okay, so when they come back to Middle Earth and a bunch of the Noldor get killed, eventually Fingon becomes the High King of the Noldor. And if you're of Noldor ancestry, even if you're noble, you have your allegiance to Fingon above all. And so Fingon gets killed in the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, which you talked about in the setup to the Fall of Gondolin. And he gets like wiped out by a Balrog. Like a Balrog basically smushes him. Like just beats him to death. Like, and it was sad, but it was super epic. And it was like, well, if you're going to die in an epic way, you succeeded, Fingon. Nice job. Anyways, his kid was Gil-galad. And Gil-galad, before that battle, he had entrusted to Círdan, the shipwright that's always on the seaside, to just take care of him. And so Gil-galad then becomes the High King of the Noldor after his dad dies. Okay. And that's for the really, really dorky people out there. Yes, there's an alternative family tree, but I'm just going with the one that's in the published Silmarillion just because it's easier, okay? Plus, I also like that one better. So, not that, like, I guess I can have a say on that, but I'm going to take a say. So he's the High King of the Noldor, and I guess that might be, since you're king, I guess that, you know, that has to go to a man. So I guess Galadriel can't have it. Plus, she's from, like, a lesser branch. She's the daughter of the second son. She's the fourth. Oh, according to me, she's the fifth child, according to my timeline, my family tree, of the second son. So, like, she's, like, just a lesser branch. So, just hereditarily, she shouldn't get the kingship, as opposed to if it was based on merit, maybe she would.
Right.
Okay. Anyways, so Gil-galad's in Lindon. Sauron's coming for him. But at this time, you know, Gil-galad had sent out Elrond to go, like, kind of mess with Sauron a little bit and just hold him back. And that's when Elrond established Rivendell, as we talked about. But Gil-galad had also sent out messages to the Numenoreans, like, asking for help. Like, hey, Sauron's really bearing down on us. We're going to need help really bad. And so, like I said, the Numenoreans, they really don't have anything better to do. And they are the best seamen in the world at this point. So they send a giant fleet to him, but the fleet gets lost. But, of course, it arrives in the nick of time in Lindon so that they can go defeat Sauron, who's attacking them, like, right down, bearing down on them right there. So they attack Sauron, defeat him, and then Sauron has to just keep retreating, and he retreats back, like, 3 or 4 times. And every single time since the Numenoreans had gotten lost, they had sailed too far south. They had left, like, little contingency armies, like, along the way. And so those armies just keep ambushing Sauron, and he just keeps getting screwed over and just wrecked every time. And so he ends up retreating all the way back across the Anduin towards, like, Mordor again. Basically, he comes away with just, like, basically, like, the household bodyguard. So, you know, like, the 20 to 100 men that, like, protect you. So that... So,
but basically, his entire army is gone.
Right. Humiliating defeat. Okay. Like, really, really bad. So that's good news, you know?
So the Numenorean are pretty epic.
The Numenorean... So they're men, and, yeah, they're pretty cool. They're going to get their own special at some point, because they become not so cool, but...
Okay.
Yeah, how about that quote there, though?
At this time, the first council was held, and it was there determined that an Elvish stronghold in the east of Eriador should be maintained in Imladris, rather than in the Region. At that time, also, Gil-galad gave Vilya, the Blue Ring, to Elrond, and appointed him to be his vice-regent in Eriador. But the Red Ring he kept, until he gave it to Círdan when he set out from Lindon in the days of the Last Alliance. For many years, the Westlands had peace, and time in which to heal their wounds. But the Numenoreans had tasted power in Middle-earth, and from that time forward, they began to make permanent settlements on the western coasts, becoming too powerful for Sauron to attempt to move west out of Mordor for a long time. In its concluding passage, the narrative returns to Galadriel, telling that the sea longing grew so strong in her, though she deemed it her duty to remain in Middle-earth while Sauron was still unconquered, she determined to leave Lorinand and to dwell near the sea. She committed Lorinand to Amroth, and passing again through Moria with Celebrian, she came to Imladris, seeking Celeborn. There, it seems, she found him, and there they dwelt together for a long time, and it was then that Elrond first saw Celebrian, and loved her, though he said nothing of it. It was while Galadriel was in the Imladris that the council referred to above was held. But at some later time, Galadriel and Celeborn, together with Celebrienne, departed from Imladris and went to the little inhabited lands between the mouth of the Gwathlo and Ethyr Anduin. There they dwelt in Bel Thalas, at the place that was afterwards called Dol Amroth. There Amroth, their son, at times visited them, and their company was swelled by Nandoran elves from Lorinand. It was not until far on in the Third Age, when Amroth was lost and Lorinand was in peril, that Galadriel returned there, in the year 1981. Here the text concerning Galadriel and Celeborn comes to an end.
Okay, that's not the end of our special, though. And that's 1981 in the Third Age, not our 1981. Which the hit song was what?
I don't know. 1981?
I'll look it up and insert it here. Okay, so, couple things there. Okay, just a fun one. Elrond first saw Celebrienne and had the hots for her. Okay, wonder how that one's going to end. We'll see.
Okay.
Which is their daughter. And then Amroth, their son, is going to rule Lothlorien while they go to the mouth of the Anduin. So, you know, we know the Anduin at this point. That's the big... It's like the Mississippi River of Middle Earth during Lord of the Rings time. So at the bottom of it. So that in Lord of the Rings time, that's a province of Gondor. But apparently there's an elf settlement there. So the idea at the end of whenever he was drafting the story was that they just settled there. TBD, because... I'm gonna burst that bubble. I must say, this lady sounds like a female Rod Stewart, and I was very shocked how already 80s 1981 was. And they screwed up that this was not the best song. The gods make wrong with us. Their minds. Back to this concept that Amroth is actually their son. Okay, we had a whole song about him in Lord of the Rings itself. If he was really their son, there's no way we don't hear a mention of it and just have a song about him that's really sad and about how he gets lost and stuff, okay? All right, so that idea is definitely rejected later on. So what he really just becomes is he's just some unrelated king of Lorien before Galadriel and Celeborn ever got there, okay?
Okay.
His capital is at Cirin Amroth, which is that hill at the end of the first Lothlorien chapter where Frodo and Haldir climbed up to the top of the flat, and then they had that amazing view of like all of Lothlorien, but they could see Dol Guldur in the background.
Right, right.
Yeah, so that was awesome. Okay, right? So that was his house. That was like, and he was the first one, I think, to live in tree houses. So that was his view every morning. He was the first one to come up with that. The main city that Galadriel and Celeborn live in wasn't invented yet. So that was pretty sweet on his part. Nice job. But yeah, he's not related to them. He's just the king that lived there before him. But Christopher Tolkien, in this Unfinished Tales chapter, he inserts the story with an explanation of the Amroth and Nimrodel song that we heard in the first Lothlorien chapter. It's short, and it's weird, and it's a downer, so I'm not going to read it. But I will describe it, because we got to know what happened to this king so that we understand what happens to the kingdom afterwards.
Yeah. Well, just so we're clear on the first version that we just read right before this. This first version we read... He's the son of Galadriel and Celeborn.
Yeah.
Galadriel wants to live by the ocean. She's got this longing.
At the end of it.
Longing for the sea. Yeah. So she leaves Lorien.
Yeah.
And Amroth takes over.
Yeah.
And he's there. Whereas this is now, we're now suggesting that he's unrelated. He's like an older king who's there. And then at some point after he leaves, Galadriel and Celeborn show up.
Right.
Okay.
Cool. All right, so just start going with that idea now, but we'll fully form it a little bit. But there was no other way to tell that story besides just assuming Amroth was their kid, so that's why I did that for that section. Mm-hmm. But now I'm telling you, forget what I just said. An hour 10 into this special. We're getting close, though. Okay. All right, so he's the King of Lorien, right? And he falls in love with this elf called Nimrodel, which is where that river gets its name, right? And we heard about her in the song. So she turns him down unless he can bring her to a land of peace. Because at this point, Sauron's around, and so now they've been used to peace with when Morgoth was just in the north of Beleriand, but now Sauron's in the east in Mordor, so that's kind of close to them. So now they're getting used to war now, and she doesn't like it. So she's like, if you can take me to a peaceful land, I'll go with you. And then Amroth says, yeah, I could probably do that, but we'll have to cross the sea to Valinor because there's no more peaceful realms in Middle-earth. That's just not possible anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They set out to the mouths of Anduin, and they're going to sail across the sea from there as opposed to going like the Grey Havens because apparently there's an elf haven down there.
Mm-hmm.
But on the way they get separated, Amroth reaches the havens. We don't know how they get separated either. Amroth reaches the havens, and there's a last ship there of elves who's ready to take off. But they try to wait for Nimrodel. But then this huge storm comes, and it unmoors their boat. And apparently they were sleeping in the boat, I guess. I probably wouldn't like sleeping in a boat, but they did. The elf boat just starts rolling with it, and they just set sail for Valinor because they're pretty sure that they can just sail across the sea because they're elves. And we won't get shipwrecked. But Amroth is distressed because obviously Nimrodel's not with them, and he wants her to come with to the Blessed Realm. So he jumps out and tries to swim back to Middle-earth in the middle of a storm. And so, surprise, surprise, it was a very far swim. And again, there's a storm going on, so he drowns. And meanwhile, Nimrodel probably fell under some sort of sleeping enchantment, I think is what I read.
Well, hold on. Does it actually say that Amroth drowns?
Oh, you read it too. You tell me.
I didn't think that it, I thought it, the storm had ended at that point and that he doesn't actually drown.
Oh, the storm might end, the storm might have ended, but it was still a far swim, so I assumed he drowned.
Okay. Okay. Keep going.
Okay, so Nimrodel meanwhile, she falls under some sort of sleeping enchantment while she's like I think near the White Mountains, and then after that she does wake up eventually, but then she just gets lost in the White Mountains. Those are the mountains like right behind Gondor. And no one knows what happened to her. And so that's how that story ends.
So I've got, the mariners with their elvish sight could for a long time see him battling with the waves until the rising sun gleamed through the clouds and far off lit his bright hair like a spark of gold. No eyes of elves or men ever saw him again in Middle-earth. Of what befell Nimrodel nothing is said here, though there are many legends concerning her fate. So he just disappears, right?
Yeah, that means he drowned, dude.
Okay,
that's my idea. I guess
it leaves open this mystery, like maybe they, you know, got reunited or are searching for her, but
I highly doubt they got reunited, but I would accept that he made it to Middle Earth and he just walks down the coast because that has happened before too with elves. Like they just walk off the story like way out like south or I don't know where, but just along the coastline. Okay, I'll accept that one. But
stage right.
Right. I'd assume he drowned. Okay.
Okay.
Anyways, all of that, actually, none of that story, of course, matches up with the Galadriel and Celeborn story that we've heard just plowed through for so long. Okay. So if we reject that Celeborn and Galadriel ended up settling at the Havens in the Anduin, because, like, Amroth just went there, which supposedly they had been settling there. So it's like, okay, we got to throw that idea out because that doesn't make any sense with this story. And this story, I think we're going to say, is official because it made it into a Lord of the Rings song, okay? And if we reject that Amroth, their kid, because, like, we would have heard mention of that if there was a song, you know? Like, they would have talked about it when they were in the talking to Galadriel. We have to assume that he's an unrelated ruler of Lorien. So if we go with that, this next passage starts to fit. You want to read that?
But during the Third Age, Galadriel became filled with foreboding. And with Celeborn, she journeyed to Lorien and stayed there long with Amroth, being especially concerned to learn all the news and rumors of the growing shadow in Mirkwood, the dark stronghold in Dol Guldur. But his people were content with Amroth. He was valiant and wise, and his little kingdom was yet prosperous and beautiful. Therefore, after long journeys of inquiry into Rovanion, from Gondor in the borders of Mordor to Thranduil in the north, Celeborn and Galadriel passed over the mountains to Enladris, where they dwelt for many years, for Elrond was their kinsman, since he had early in the Third Age wedded their daughter Celebrienne. After the disaster in Moria in the year 1980, and the sorrows of Lorien, which was now left without a ruler, for Amroth had was drowned in the sea in the Bay of Belphalas.
There we go.
Celeborn and Galadriel returned to Lorien and were welcomed by the people. There they dwelt while the Third Age lasted, but they took no title of king or queen, for they said that they were only guardians of this small but fair realm, the last eastward outpost of the elves.
Okay, and then additionally there was this note too. To Lorien, Celeborn, and Galadriel returned twice before the last alliance in the end of the Second Age, and in the Third Age, when the shadow of Sauron's recovery arose, they dwelt there again for a long time. In her wisdom, Galadriel saw that Lorien would be a stronghold and point of power to prevent the shadow from crossing the Anduin in a war that must inevitably come before it was again defeated, if it were possible, but that it needed a ruler of greater strength and wisdom than the Sylvan folk possessed. Nevertheless, it was not until the disaster of Moria, when by means is beyond the foresight of Galadriel, Sauron's power actually crossed the Anduin, and Lorien was in great peril, its king lost, its people fleeing, and likely to leave it deserted, to likely be occupied by orcs, that Galadriel and Celeborn took up their permanent abode in Lorien and its government. Alright, so that was a lot, but that's basically how they get him there. In the middle of the Third Age, I guess.
Okay. And are we assuming that we hold to our original storyline where Galadriel had been somewhere near Lorien Lorien?
Yeah, she had visited it before, but then after Sauron was defeated with that humiliating defeat, it sounds like she kind of just bounced around a lot of time, just living in Rivendell, especially since Elrond married her daughter.
Right.
And then eventually, after wandering not to the havens of Gondor, because that's where this separate Amroth guy goes, when Amroth's gone, and then the disaster of Moria that they're talking about, that's when Durin's folk get kicked out by the Balrog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's Durin's bane. Their disaster. After that, she's like, okay, Lorien, this is a strategic place that we have to hold. I'm going to go be ruler of that so that we can do
it. She lets go of her love of the sea. And returns back to the forest in an effort.
Well, that was a weird idea. That love of the sea was originally an idea that came with the ring. Like, when she got the ring, that was started kindled.
Okay.
But I think Tolkien dropped it because it's not very... It doesn't really connect to anything. Like, I don't quite get why that would come up. If I was Tolkien, I'd reject that idea, too.
But point being, she makes this decision about, like, kind of the big strategy at hand. It's not a self-sacrificial move, but she recognizes she's, like, planning for this battle down the road.
What we saw in Lord of the Rings, that whole Lothlorien chapter, which we arguably called the coolest chapter so far, I think she knows that that's what that place is going to turn into, too. Like, she knows what she's doing when she has this ring. Now, speaking of that, we got one last topic to cover, and then we got our conclusion, and then we're almost done. So we got to talk about another stone/jewel thingy, okay? We've had lots of those. We've had rings. We've had jewels. This one's a stone, okay? So this will fit with Lothlorien and Galadriel, and it'll be significant to other characters too throughout the Lord of the Rings, okay? So that's why we got to cover this. So Tolkien starts with this idea that at some point Celebrimbor wasn't actually a grandson of Fëanor, but that he was just some smith from Gondolin, and he was probably like the first or second best smith ever, okay? Now, that could actually still work. He could still be the grandson of Fëanor when he rejects his dad and just keeps living in Nargothrond. And then Nargothrond goes to the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, where Fingon gets killed and everything. And then most of the Noldor retreat with Turgon to Gondolin. And that's, if you remember, like, just to jive your memory, that's when Húrin and Huor set up that last defense so that the elves could escape. And Huor is the dad of Tuor, who goes to Gondolin eventually. And then Húrin is the dad of Turin, who defeats the dragon. But Húrin is, like, taken captive because he's the last man left, and he kills, like, 70 orcs, literally, like, 70 orcs straight before they take him alive. Anyways, so Celebrimbor could potentially be with the people that escaped to Gondolin, and then after that, he escapes out with Tuor and Indril and Kid Arendil, you know, and then he gets away. Okay. Potentially. We don't really know how Celebrimbor survives the Silmarillion. It's actually one of my big questions, but I'll just go with it that he does. Okay. So, in Gondolin, Celebrimbor, why don't you take that quote? What did he love?
Celebrimbor loved all green things that grew, and his greatest joy was to see the sunlight through the leaves of trees. And it came into his heart to make a jewel within which the clear light of the sun should be imprisoned, but the jewel should be as green as leaves. And he made this thing, and even the Noldor marveled at it. For it is said that those who looked through the stone saw things that were withered or burned healed again, or as they were in the grace of their youth, and that the hands of one who held it brought to all that they touched healing from hurt. This gem Celebrimbor gave to Idril, the king's daughter, and she wore it upon her breast, so that it was saved from the burning of Gondolin. And before Idril set sail, she said to Arendil, her son, "The Elisar I leave thee, for there are grievous hurts to Middle-earth, which thou maybe shalt heal. But to none other shalt thou deliver it." And indeed at Sirion's Haven there were many hurts to heal, both of men and elves, and of the beasts that fled thither from the horror of the north. And while Arendil dwelt there, they were healed and prospered, and all things were for a while green and fair. But when Arendil began his great voyages upon the sea, he wore the Elisar upon his breast, for amongst all his searchings the thought was always before him, that he might perhaps find Idril again. And his first memory of Middle-earth was the green stone above her breast, as she sang above his cradle, while Gondolin was still in flower. So it was that the Elisar passed away, when Arendil returned no more to Middle-earth.
Okay, did you follow all that?
Vaguely. The Elisar is this green stone.
Right, like it heals the land, kind of.
Yeah.
Okay, and Arendil had it, because Celebrimbor made it for Indril, who's his mom, who we talked about in the Gondolin specials and everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then she gives it to Arendil, who we just had the whole special about. Mm-hmm. And now, in actuality, by the time of the published Silmarillion, I think Christopher Tolkien just kind of assumed, like, it was the Silmaril that Elwing brought to the Havens that kind of healed him. But anyways, I guess the stone has, like, this healing ability, too, that, like, I mean, it's a precursor to the Rings of Power. You know, like, that's exactly, like, these rings, like, the Elven rings help you preserve the land and everything.
Right, right, right.
But so does the stone to a lesser extent. And Celebrimbor made one of these, okay? But that stone went into the west with Arendil and mm-hmm. presumably is still with them. Now, here's the thing, though. This Elisar stone thingy, this elf stone, there's two varying stories that I don't think Tolkien wanted to commit to. That's why he wrote two stories about it. And he's just like, oh, I don't know which one's real. Like, that's literally what he's writing. So there's two stories about what happened to this thing. The first one is full of spoilers, and it's basically that someone from Valinor brought back that very one that Arendil took to Valinor when he went sailing. They give it to Galadriel. Now, that story doesn't make a ton of sense to me, because if you bring something back from Arendil, why would you give it to Galadriel and not Elrond, who's his living son?
Okay.
So I think that's weird. Plus, the timing of that story is just very off. And it's got spoilers, so we're not going to cover that story. Now, the second story here, Celebrimbor, who survived the Elder Days, which is the First Age, he comes to Eregion, and now, at this point, this is before Sauron shows up, and before they're making Rings of Power and everything, Galadriel comes to Celeborn, and she's super sad, and she says, "I am grieved in Middle-earth, for leaves fall and flowers fade that I have loved, so that the land of my dwelling is filled with regret that no spring can redress." And so she's basically, like, sad that, like, I don't know, Middle-earth is kind of passing away. Like, especially looking back at the Elder Days, her whole family, most of her cousins, all dead. You know, like, all of her kinsfolk mm-hmm. are dead. She's, like, the only one left. Time of the Elves is starting to wane away, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And she's selling this to Celebrimbor. And so after some conversation, Celebrimbor offers or maybe agrees or decides that he's going to make a new Elisar stone for Galadriel to use, okay?
Okay.
So he makes this new one, and this is what Galadriel uses to bring Lothlorien back to, like, that Edenic state that we were talking about in the
mm-hmm.
that first mm-hmm. Lothlorien chapter, like, how it was, like, outside of time and so cool and, like, perfect and awesome. You might read that sentence there.
"Wielding the Elisar, all things grew fair about Galadriel until the coming of the Shadow to the forest. But afterwards, when Nenya, chief of the three, was sent to her by Celebrimbor, she needed it, as she thought, no more, and she gave it to Celebrion, her daughter. And so it came to Arwen."
Okay, so when she got the Ring of Power, this was basically like an upgraded version of that Elisar stone.
But she can't actually put on the Ring of Power, right?
No, she puts the Ring of Power back on after Sauron's defeated. After Isildur cuts the ring, she can put on the Ring of Power. So that's okay. After that, she would have passed it on.
But basically, the beauty and splendor of Lorien is not due to the Ring of Power. It's because of this Elisar.
No. I think it is more so due to the Ring of Power, but it was started off by this Elisar stone.
Okay. But at some point, she passes on the Ring of Power.
Right, and she passes on to her daughter. And then Celebrion, Elrond's wife, we actually talked about how she was attacked by orcs when she was crossing the Misty Mountains, and she was so tormented that her son saved her, but she was so tormented and, like, she just went to across the sea back to Valinor.
Mm-hmm.
Basically recover. So before she left, she gave it to her daughter, Arwen. Of course, like we just said, this Elfstone, that's a precursor to the Rings of Power and, like, the Nenya ring that Galadriel gets. But this was a pretty powerful jewel and everything. Okay, so this is, like, a good thing to keep track of, especially if it's still here in Middle-earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, we've already had mention of this thing in Lord of the Rings so far. Can you guess where?
Something to do with Arwen?
Kinda, I guess. Softly.
In Rivendell.
Yes, it's in Rivendell.
I don't know.
Okay, when Bilbo is making that song about Arendelle...
Yeah.
He consults who?
Aragorn.
Right. And so then afterwards, after the song, he was joking with the elves. He's just like, oh, come on, you got to pick out which parts I wrote and which parts Aragorn wrote, right? Remember that?
Uh-huh.
And so then Bilbo whispers to Frodo that he said, I actually wrote the whole thing. It's just Aragorn insisted that we had to mention this elf stone thingy. And Bilbo, like, literally doesn't even understand what it is, you know? But that's this. That's what they're talking about. Uh-huh. Okay? Which is kind of funny.
Okay.
Now.
Good to know.
Right. That is good to know, especially since it's Aragorn that's insisting on mentioning it, that Arendelle took it. And obviously, he's probably referring to this first one that actually went across the sea. Okay? Because, you know,
okay.
Arendelle doesn't bring it back, right? Okay. Keep that in mind. All right? Okay. With that, we can go to the final wrap-up of this, and I want to try to tie this back to why this is significant for us reading these Lothlorien chapters in Lord of the Rings here. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, fast forward all the way to the Fellowship arriving in Lothlorien, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're at the cusp or beginning, or things are really ramping up for that final inevitable war against Sauron that Galadriel has long predicted.
Right.
So here comes the Fellowship with the One Ring, the ring that masters her own ring that she's wearing. Because, you know, mm-hmm. she has Nenya, and this is the most powerful of the three elf rings. And this is, with this ring, this is how she's preserving Lothlorien, and it's like a paradise outside of time. She made Lothlorien the greatest place in Middle-earth. And she's mm-hmm. achieved that, and she's ruling the realm that she had set out to rule when she left Valinor originally. So she's finally actually doing that. I had criticized, you went through the whole Silmarillion and you didn't have a kingdom of your own. Well, she's achieved mm-hmm. it now, right? By the time of Lord of the Rings, like, she's in it, and she's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, here comes the One Ring, Sauron's ruling ring. Sauron, who she's wanted to defeat so badly. But if they destroy his ring, that would mean the end of her realm, the end of paradise on Earth, and the end of her people. And they probably have to leave Middle Earth. This is the end of the elves, probably. We mm-hmm. probably talked about this in other chapters, but, like, we're starting to stress this really heavily. Like, this is the mm-hmm. end of the elves. And so now she has to aid one of presumably the least powerful creatures in the world to take this ring into the heart of Sauron's realm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's, like, questionable whether you go with that, you know, because it's like, all right, well, Sauron could just get this back and then I'm screwed.
Right.
My whole realm screwed, and then the whole world screwed.
Right. And she's kind of a go-getter. Like, she's not really taking orders from anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So even if there was a plan in place, she certainly has a history of saying, no, I'm going to do this.
Right. I mean, she wants to do what's best for Middle-earth in general. I think she's, like, she's worthy that she wants to, like, fight evil and actual evil and stuff. But,
right.
I mean, she's pretty prudent and, like, smart and practical. And it's just, like, you don't mm-hmm. want to just walk something over to the enemy.
Right.
And so then, while the Fellowship's recovering in Lothlorien, this very humble ring bearer freely offers to give her the One Ring instead of going to destroy it. Okay?
Yeah.
At this point, after going through this whole special, I hope you can understand that this is a very, very tempting offer. Here's the ruling ring that not only is she going to be powerful enough to defeat her archenemy for the past literally 5,000 years,
mm-hmm.
she gets to increase her own power, keep her realm, and order the world as she sees fit. You know, like, hopefully for good reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
But she, like Gandalf, and unlike Saruman, she realizes too that, no, you know, I can't be using this ring for good intentions. That's not going to work. This is the sort of power that's just always going to turn to evil, right?
Right.
But this is like when Frodo's offering her the ring here, this is what she's saying. When she says, I passed the test, when she rejects it, you know, like she was tempted because she's very tempted. Like when mm-hmm. we read the chapter, she's tempted. But she does say no. And then she's like, well, wow. Wow, that was big. I just passed the test. And it's like, okay, hopefully after going through the special, yeah, that was big. Holy shit, you did pass the test. Like, you get a glimpse mm-hmm. of it in Lord of the Rings. Like, okay, she seems like a powerful person. And like, yeah, she's powerful. And like, if she had the ring, she could really wreck stuff in the Middle Earth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, no. Now, hopefully, we just went through to show you how powerful she really is. And this was a massive test. You know, like, this is, like, her whole life was leading up to this, really. Because by this point, she'd been out, she'd seen the whole wide world. You know, any selfish desire she had to rule and, like, have a kingdom of her own and have power from, like, the days when she was living in Valinor, when she wanted to leave Valinor and go back to Middle-earth, those have to be gone by now because she did pass this test. Basically, at this point, it's like, well, she's accomplished everything in Middle-earth and she doesn't overextend her reach and power. We had said, like, it was kind of music of Ainur stuff, desiring your own selfish ambitions to go rule something. It seems like she knows how to keep herself at least somewhat in check, and she's like, I don't know, that's like worked out to her benefit, or she's achieved how far she should.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Setting all the like epic descriptions aside, she's the greatest of all the Noldor except Fëanor. Even if you put that aside, she's pretty intriguing.
Yeah.
I guess I'm excited to get into the stuff that you said we weren't going to talk about here, like her significance in the story and inspiration and all of that for Tolkien. But yeah, she's one of these characters that's a little bit more peculiar, I think, than she comes off as being initially.
Right.
Like, in some ways, she's much weirder than Elrond, even though Elrond's a really big deal in our story and comes up in a lot of different places, clearly a super important character. It's like he fulfills his role in a very straightforward way.
Well, we had also seen too, like Frodo was commenting, like Rivendell seemed like it was preserving, you know, all the ancientest of ancient memories, but Lothlorien itself was the ancient memory. So it's like,
yeah,
this superlative conversation. It's just like Elrond's one thing, and then Galadriel just raises the bar, period. Like she's the ultimate elf. but we'll get into that in the actual chapters itself. A couple other minor points and stuff to look forward to throughout the series that we gotta just remind before we end this. Again, remember there's some sort of elf haven in the Anduin. Okay, that'll come up later deep into this series.
Okay.
All right, so you're storing that in there?
Elf haven in the Anduin.
Okay, good. Okay.
Where's the wait, tell me, where's this coming from?
Amroth went down to sail off from that haven. Remember?
Down, this is like down at the delta of the Anduin.
Yeah, yeah. Like okay. the New Orleans of Middle Earth.
Okay.
Okay. Now, also, remember how her hair was inspiring Fëanor to possible inspiration for Fëanor to create the Silmarils?
Yeah.
He was asking her what? What was he specifically demanding?
He wanted some of her hair.
Right. And how many times did he ask?
I can't remember.
It's a magic number. Just go. You can get it.
100.
Hundreds of magic number.
three times.
Okay, remember that for a very soon episode. Okay. And now finally, that Elessor stone made by Celebrimbor, given to Galadriel, given to Celebrimbor once Galadriel had Nenya, and then given to Arwen, her daughter, when she left Middle Earth.
Mm-hmm.
When was the last time we saw Arwen?
We saw her in Rivendell.
Right.
With Aragorn, right?
Okay, yeah, so she was sitting with Aragorn. Okay.
And Aragorn utters her name at the end of chapter 6.
Very good, Clifford.
At Cairn Amroth.
Very good.
He just like mutters some stuff in Elvish that Frodo doesn't understand.
Yeah. Okay, so is our error, mostly mine, I won't blame Clifford for this, but that Many Meetings chapter was already going really long, and so I completely forgot to talk about that, especially since when you read the book, like, okay, you could probably kind of tell Aragorn's with her, but if you hadn't seen the movie, maybe you don't know that. Anyways, mm-hmm. Aragorn and Arwen, they're a thing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So Arwen presumably has this Elessor right now, okay? And Aragorn mm-hmm. was also the one insisting that you talk about this Elessor thing in any sort of song about Arendelle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all that significant. I think it comes up in soon chapters, or it'll come up very deep into the series as well. But keep that in mind.
Okay. All right,
so that's some fun stuff to look forward to. Hopefully we far advanced your Middle Earth dorky knowledge in this chapter.
Uh-huh.
But that's all I got, which is good because this has been long.
Okay.
Anything else from you?
No, that's it. Okay. Stay tuned for chapter 8.
Yeah, cool. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, y'all.